Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
We are here at the 2025 NATA convention here in Orlando, Florida. We have the pleasure of having Dr. Chris Ingersoll. He's the Senior Associate Dean at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine and the Chair of Department of Health Sciences. It's a pleasure to have him with us. He's wearing his Hall of Fame jacket, so obviously incredibly distinguished guest.
With the green jacket from the Masters.
No, my Masters is a little different shade.
Yeah, actually, I think it's better than the Masters.
His Masters jacket is hanging in his saucer. So as I mentioned, he is the chair of the Department of Health Sciences at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Department of Health Sciences is?
Sure. The Department of Health Sciences started 50-some years ago as the first Department of Allied Health Sciences at UNC within the medical school. And at the time, it was just a couple of programs that sort of evolved from training programs that were in the hospital. So we're also a large academic health center with 19 hospitals throughout the state. But so they just, like many of the allied health professions, evolved up into having more formal training, became academic programs. And that was the place where those programs came up. Now it's 8 different divisions within that. And we're in the School of Medicine, and we're like a school within a school. We have a fair amount of autonomy, but we're kind of treated the same way that the clinical departments are. So we're like budgeted and evaluated kind of like the Department of Orthopedics or the Department of Medicine or whatever the case may be. So that's our current structure within within that. So as the department chair, I oversee those 8 divisions and their programs. And then as senior associate dean, in the School of Medicine, then I sort of represent all of the health professions in the leadership of the school.
So we were talking earlier that in the School of Medicine, the focus at the School of Medicine is the MD track and the residency. But for the Department of Health Sciences, you have 8 different programs under you. So what are some of the challenges that you see in managing all those different programs while the School of Medicine, although unique and challenging in its own right, has more of a singular take?
Right. And we have 8 divisions, but we actually have about 12 different programs. There are multiple programs within some of them. And we have about 10 accrediting bodies that we have to deal with. So, in medicine, you have the one accrediting body that you deal with. We have to do those. So that's a complexity that we deal with that necessarily doesn't span across the rest of the School of Medicine. But they're very supportive of that. They get it, that we're sort of a similar infrastructure within medicine. And we sort of line up with the other clinical departments, as you might imagine. So our clinical laboratory science program lines up well with pathology, for example. And our speech-language pathology and audiology programs line up pretty well with otolaryngology and things of that nature. So that's sort of how we're set up. But we're in an institution where there are other health programs. So there's a School of Nursing and Pharmacy and Dentistry and Public Health. And so we're largely a health-related university at this point.
Now, at what level of students are you seeing? Is it entry level? Is it like a baccalaureate? Is it a master's? Is it a doctoral level?
Yes.
All the above.
It's all the above, yeah. So we have a few undergraduate BS programs. We have several master's programs. Most of our master's programs are clinical, accredited clinical training programs. And then our doctoral programs, we have both PhD programs, and then we have like a professional doctorate, like AUD or DPT within the department as well.
Our live series at the NATA convention is sponsored by MetOne Technologies. Looking for innovation in orthopedics? Meet the only U.S.-based, Latin-owned manufacturer originally focused on spinal implants, now leading the way in upper and lower extremity solutions. They've just expanded their portfolio with the newly launched Fortis Distal Radius Plating System, 510K cleared and designed for next-level performance. This isn't just progress, it's representation, precision, and results all in one. Today's episode is sponsored by Get Raw, a potent antioxidant blend made with all raw organic ingredients. The Get Raw ginger turmeric formulation is 200 to 300 times more bioavailable to the human body. Documented benefits include decreased inflammation, improved digestion, immunity, cognition, and more. Get healthy, get well, get raw, the organic wellness shot.
Tell us a little bit more about UNC as an institution. Looking at your background, you've worked at a lot of fabulous institutions, University of Virginia, University of Central Florida, which is actually based here in Orlando, Central Michigan. But now, you know, I know personally the medical school at University of North Carolina is absolutely top notch, and I'm sure the Department of Health Sciences is as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about the funding that goes into UNC and the initiative and the type of students that you see?
Sure. I'll start from the last and go to the beginning, but the type of students we see varies between the different programs. And as you can imagine, recruiting students into a bachelor's program, for example, is a different sort of thing than attracting PhD students. So like the rest of our mantra, it just depends. You know, it's a lot of different approaches in order to meet the needs of the specific programs.
You know, UNC is a top-notch institution that receives a lot of federal funding, a lot of National Institute of Health funding, as well as a lot of private funding. How have you seen that, or how are you able to use that based on your experience from other large academic institutions?
Yeah, well, I think the one advantage of institutions that have that sort of research infrastructure is it honestly makes it easier for the investigator to be successful, right? We have an infrastructure that helps with the writing proposals for NIH grants, for example. There is support post-award type of supports are helpful as well. And then we also have a number of NIH-funded institutes that help everybody. So we have like the NC TRACS, which is an award from the NIH that helps fund clinical research and prepare clinical researchers. So we have infrastructures like that we can introduce our faculty to, and it really prepares them to be successful with those type of things. I think being in a very large academic health system also helps a lot. So we have 19 hospitals across the state of North Carolina. So that's a lot of patients that we look after. You know, that connects us to a lot of people across the state for recruitment for research, for example. So our sources of funding certainly come from extramural funding for research, and also contract work that we might do. We also get dollars from the state. We are a state institution that help underwrite the costs, mostly of the academic programs. The research mission is largely funded through the external funds that we bring in.
What is some of the research that you're really focusing on now with within the department? Mm-hmm. Is being more prevalent now than it would have been a year or two ago, or even looking more prospectively in the future?
Well, I think that it varies. We have a lot of different areas, so they're interested in everything from autism to stroke to optimizing laboratory techniques. So it really does depend on the different profession, or hearing aids or cochlear implants or all those type of things.
I was going to say, what do you think of the quality of literature being published? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the academic sphere, there's a push to produce and publish. And that raises you in the ranks of the hierarchy of academia. And I do a lot of literature review, we write papers, etc. And I think sometimes you see a dilution of good literature with not good literature, because there's just such a rush to push information out there. Mm-hmm. So methodologically flawed studies, small cohorts, level 5 evidence, case studies, etc. Do you feel that the quality is just as good as it's ever been? Better, because you're more rigorous at UNC?
Well, I think, if we think about all of the literature, I think certainly there's been dilution for lots of reasons, right? There's pressure on at all institutions for faculty to publish, with varying levels of infrastructure to help support to do those type of things. And so institutions that are fortunate enough to have good research infrastructure can do the highest level evidence studies, right? They have the infrastructure to do that. At the others, they may not have a lot of time. They have to find whatever they can, right, in order to publish. And, you know, I think to dichotomize that as good or bad is probably not the way to think about it. Sure. But, you know, there certainly can be good research that comes from a small institution, and there can also be lousy research that comes from very reputable institutions. And add into that the growing prevalence of predatory publishers. And so they'll say, well, you know, for just X number of dollars, we can get this published for right. you. And they do a quote unquote peer review, but it's not rigorous. And so those studies find their way into the literature.
What I found is that actually some of those predatory journals have a higher impact factor than you would actually fit. So you're paying a substantial amount of money to get your possibly methodologically flawed research published. But then I think the impact factors are also artificially inflated in these journals, which kind of makes it a double-edged sword. Not only are you paying to have your questionable research published, but it's also being published and maybe disseminated more widely than you'd like and maybe being taken more seriously than it should.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, the story behind the bibliometrics is important to talk about too. It's like, you can have a lot of people citing your paper because it's wrong.
Correct.
And, you know, so.
Correct.
So, yeah, you're getting the citations, but is that really contributing, valuable knowledge to the thing? And as I said, you might find a good paper in one of those journals. You know, it just depends on who they caught when and, you know, what they had in hand when they did it. But it's not so easy sometimes to differentiate those things. But
is there an initiative or a project that at UNC right now that you're excited about?
So I just finished my first year, and as soon as I started, we did a strategic planning process. And so the School of Medicine had completed a strategic plan. So we decided to create some key results, which are just measurable things that we're going to do relative to that. We jumped right into that and we created those. So, and they're kind of in the four different pillars: in research, education, clinical care, and then caring for our people. So those were the four main areas that we're interested in. So we have some things that we're going to do to improve in those four areas.
Great.
You know, within research, for example, again, it kind of depends on the area that you're looking at, but we are looking at opportunities to build on some strengths that we have. And so, you know, you look within UNC, there are some great centers that do things in genetics, for example, or in stroke or things of that nature. And of course, we try to find ways to connect to that when we can.
Now, is there certain areas that you need to focus on because of funding? I know you mentioned something about funding earlier. Or does it not matter as long as it falls under the criteria of within the standards of that grant or?
Yeah, we don't dictate the kind of research that our faculty do. So they can kind of pick what they're interested in. We're more interested in the quality of the work that they do for what they select. But that being said, certainly we'll recruit faculty because they have a certain expertise and we want them to publish and get grants in that area. And so, you know, one that we're working on right now, for example, is vestibular rehab. And so that's kind of a joint thing between our audiology and our PT faculty, looking to have not only a research enterprise for that, but have a clinic that would attract the patients and sort of full service, right? You know, you're serving patients, we're advancing the knowledge, and then we're applying that new knowledge to the patients that we see in that clinic. So
yeah, and that's great research because in the PT world and even in the athlete training world, you're applying that vestibular rehabilitation for people that have had concussion or somebody that may just have a vestibular issue that isn't concussion related. So how do you now see how that's changed over time? But, you know, what are you seeing in the current literature and research that is going to make these patients better? Because we have patients that come into our clinics that there's therapists that don't know how to deal with that type of patient because they haven't had training.
Mm-hmm. You know, and some of that is our health system. It's like, we don't know how to help these people. We need to be better here. And so that's part of the motivation to try to build something around that area because we see it enough that, and we see the opportunity, right, to be able to recruit great faculty into that.
Yeah. What about the interprofessional collaboration across the School of Medicine, physicians and people in the Department of Health Sciences, and how can we create that Venn diagram where everyone's expertise overlaps and everyone collaborates for the betterment of the location?
Yeah, so UNC did something I thought was really meaningful in terms of their intention towards having an interprofessional education and practice program. And they built the office that manages that in the provost's office. It's not in the School of Medicine or pharmacy, dentistry. It's in the provost's office. And that was done intentionally to say, this is a university-wide resource. It doesn't belong to anybody. It's for everybody. And so that's been fantastic, because then you don't have someone, if they don't like the way it's going, that they take their IPE and go home, right? Now, we're all involved. I would say, though, fortunately, people want to participate in that program, and they see that it's supported at the university level. And the cross sections of all the different opportunities are actually really more numerous than we could keep track of, which is great. And of course, we're trying to also extend those principles out into our practice areas across all of our health system as well, because we want our students to learn that. And then when they go out to practice, we want them to practice it and not say, well, that's something that we learned in school, but we never did do.
Does UNC collaborate with the other academic institutions in the Research Triangle? So NC State, Wake Forest, dare I say, Duke, across the back of
the... Well, the school with the wrong color blue across the road.
8 miles down.
Yeah, eight miles down the road. We just announced a couple months ago that we're going to build a children's hospital with Duke. So it'll be a joint program. And they're thinking on the level of like CHOP or Boston Children's, something like that, that would be right there in the triangle. It's in the earliest stages, but at this point, I think there's a commitment to do it. They're looking for a place to build this. And we're all figuring out, okay, how do we all participate? What are we going to need to do in terms of hiring? What are going to be the opportunities for student rotations to be involved with that? So it's going to be a really exciting thing for us in Duke, but the whole region and even the nation. We envision this to be a place where people would fly in to go to this place.
We work with physicians out of Boston Children's and out of CHOP. So our physician went from one of ours that worked in Boston Children's to CHOP. So I think those are great models for you to be able to pull from and to build a great collaborative.
They can recruit the best talent because, you know, it's just designed for them. So,
and it's just a hotbed for learning for both universities.
Yeah.
I trained at Boston Children's, and then one of my very good friends is now going to be the only pediatric hand surgeon in the state of Florida, starting in about 6 months. So I think having a top world-class children's hospital institution in North Carolina would be just amazing.
We're really hoping so.
Your friend's going to be as busy as today.
He is going to be as busy.
Yeah.
I had lunch with him a couple of days ago, and he's currently at Children's Hospital in Denver and very, very busy. He's going to be the only pediatric philosopher in Florida, the entire state.
All the kids falling at Disney, you're going to see him.
That's right.
Well, there's a few people that live in Florida, too.
There are. Yeah. He's very, very popular. What has been the biggest challenge and reward for leading a large academic institution in the time you've been there?
Well, I think it's mostly reward. I mean, that any project that you work on, you can encounter obstacles, but I guess my mindset is that's just a problem that needs to be solved, right? And if you keep your eye on the prize and what you're trying to accomplish, it really doesn't become that much of it's just part of the process. I think every institution has, you know, quirks here and there that you need to learn and do that. But that's, you know, in a big institution that has a lot of resources, they don't just give you resources, right? You have to compete for those resources. So that becomes the mindset, right? Is how do I make my proposal optimized so that I can get the support that I need? And the institution usually will provide adequate resources so that you can be successful when you've provided a cogent proposal, right?
I was gonna ask you, you're wearing a Hall of Fame jacket. We've worked at a lot of very
prestigious academic institutions. Over the decades, each decade, have your goals changed in how you approach education? So in your first decade of work, did you have one goal or mindset? In your second decade, in your third decade, what has it stayed consistent?
I think that's a hard question to answer. I think your focus changes as you move through because you know more the further you get into your career. So when I first started, I was very focused on just trying to be a successful faculty member, in the academy. Then I had the opportunity to be involved with leadership. And then I think I got sort of in a mindset that hasn't changed very much because it's pretty universal, right? I want to empower other people to be able to do their best. And I feel like that's the place in the world where I can be that can help the most. And so I don't look for this position or that position. I look for a place where I can do interesting things.
Again, that's a common thread because we ask people a similar question. What would you like to do in the future? What are your initiatives? How can you make the field of athletic training better? And really one of our guests summed it up. He said, so to speak, the golden rule, treat others as you want to be treated. But he even simplified it, clarified it for us. It's be a good dude, but be a good blank, whatever you want to fill in there, but be a good person. And it sounds like that's been your goal for your entire career.
My perspective on leadership and life starts with trust. I choose to start with trust. And my friend Stephen Covey would be proud of me for saying that. But
he is your friend. That's a nice name.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's a nice name.
It's a great book. Stephen, I'll take the check in.
Yeah.
But
come on the phone.
There you go.
We'll have him.
His point is, it for lots and lots of reasons, I need to start with trust with the people that I'm leading. Is someone going to disappoint me? Yes. But should I distrust 150 people and make them individually earn my trust along the way? That would take decades to get done. I would much rather start with trust, and then when I have disappointments, I just deal with them, And, you have to be intentional about rebuilding trust with people that either they broke trust or sometimes you do. And it may not be on purpose, but that seems like a lot less work. But when you start with trust and you tell people that you trust them, they feel empowered by that. They work to keep your trust. And I think you start with and maintain a much better culture within your organization when they believe that they're being trusted and they're willing to give trust.
What about respect? So let me give you a quick backstory. When I was in, it was either middle school or high school, Travis Roy, who was a Boston University hockey player, who was tragically paralyzed in a college hockey game from the neck down, who became a motivational speaker, Christopher Reeves type, and tragically passed away relatively recently. He always said that you don't need to earn respect. Everyone starts with 100% respect, and you either just treat everyone with 100% respect, or obviously people can do things to lose your respect. So I think you're saying with trust that everyone should inherently be trusted more or less, instead of distrusting everybody and make you keep or earn your trust. Do you think it works the same way with respect?
I do. And I start with respect. I'm going to respect you until you give me a reason not to. Yeah. And if you think about it, those two, it's really interesting that you bring that up. I think trust and respect are the only two essential elements that we need to be successful. Do you have to like me to be motivated to work and do some things?
No,
but you need to trust me and you need to respect me. And if we have those two things, we can do whatever we need to do.
We can work together very cohesively.
Yeah.
All set. That always stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how I thought about respect at that time, but I think Dr. Ingersoll was right. And now I'll take that with trust, that people more or less deserve all of your trust.
And I don't think it's dichotomous. It's like, can you lose some? Like, I didn't completely lose my trust in you, but this one just, I have that thing. I just need to, that I know I need to repair, Now, don't get me wrong. There are people that can lose 100% of your trust.
And never get it back.
Yeah, and never get it back.
Never get it
back. It is possible.
How is UNC preparing future clinicians or educators or professionals to change with technology, innovation, AI?
Yeah, that is, we could talk about that for a long time. And I think that's really interesting. We're like every other institution struggling to figure that piece out. And it's actually kind of interesting that we are. I don't know if you remember, this was about 15 years ago maybe, when Watson decided to learn medicine.
Yes.
And we were saying, we're gonna have to change our curriculum and we're gonna have to focus on anatomy, physiology, some of those basics, and then how to ask Watson the right question. We didn't do any of that. It's 15 years later, but we're kind of asking the same question again. It's like, how are we gonna use AI to become better, to provide better care? And these ideas like precision medicine, imagine the information that has to go into that. We're going to have to rely on AI to give us some choices, you know, in terms of what we might choose to do. But I believe, old fashioned or not, that in the end, the human has to make the decision.
Or medicine.
Yeah.
AI can help you scientifically, but this human providing compassion and empathy and providing the part of medicine, a hand on the shoulder, the reassurance, the human hand on the scalpel, hopefully never ages out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you have to check the work of AI. You know, a couple years ago, I was doing a leadership development program for ASAP, which is the group for our kind of units. And I thought AI was kind of like in the news. So I thought, boy, it would be interesting to start our session with that. So I asked ChatGPT, like, do people benefit from the ASAP leadership development program? And it came back with this beautifully written couple of paragraphs. It said, yes, the participants in this in the ASAP leadership position, and it used the wrong organization.
Yeah.
So they do this, and this, and they find it to be useful. So then I said, no. I mean Association of Schools Advancing Health Professions. And then it basically gave me the same paragraph back, and it just replaced the name.
It did.
Yeah. And then I said, who are the people who are saying that? And this is what it came back with. I'm sorry, I have to correct what I had said earlier. This is generally what people say when they complete. Yeah. So if I would have just stuck with any of those previous answers, I would have been speaking with a lot of conviction on the value of this program with absolutely no evidence whatsoever.
Yeah, so check.
Yeah.
Need to verify. But they are working on super intelligence, where the AI not only automates its own AI research, but eventually becomes faster, smarter, and cheaper than doing what the majority of humans can do, at least in the workforce. And then that's a Rubicon that we have to cross, which may be 2, 3, 5, or 10 years in the future. And that, I think, would change, where you're hollowing out some work systems and foundations of work systems where the value of human is significantly less. But again, your point, now we have large language models, we have chatbots, we can ask them questions, that the human still reigns supreme.
Yep. Well, and you know, it's actually a lot of fun to read all the futurists and their predictions of what's going to happen. But going back to my previous example, they said 15 years ago that it would be just a few years before Watson just kind of took over all of these jobs, and you know, it didn't. So who knows, like the ending may be very different than all of that, but I think all those things will enter into the equation, but what the power of each of those, who knows, you know?
Yeah. And we're relying on, you know, people like yourself, no pressure, but you know, guiding the future of healthcare professionals in dealing with that. And neither Riz nor I are any sort of expert on artificial intelligence, and they're just experts in their own small forum. We're looking forward to the positives that it can bring. We're also aware of the possible negatives and doing our best to shield ourselves against that, or though we are in your institution.
Yep. Well, I think we all need to be, you know, positive agents for that. And I don't think either extreme position is a healthy one, right? To just dismiss that and say that will never be valuable in patient care, I don't think that's right. But also to say that it's going to completely decide patient care, that's probably not right either, you know?
Yeah, I would have to agree with them.
Yeah.
We talk about mentorship a lot. Cam and I talk about it a bunch. I talk about it with most of my peers and colleagues. What has mentorship meant to you?
In departments like ours, that's an ongoing conversation, right? We ask faculty to come into a pretty competitive situation. We want to be able to give them all the resources we can to help them be successful. They have to do the work, but you know, we want to do that. Mentorship is a really important part of that. And not just the mentorship, like this is how you should do your research. It can also be mentorship like, okay, so if you're trying to get this course arranged, you know, that's a different sort of thing. Or now, this is kind of the political environment over here. You should probably know this before you go in and say something just so that you don't put yourself in a tough situation. It's all of those things. And I would argue that the best model is having multiple mentors, not a mentor. You know, if you come in and, well, I'm going to assign you a mentor. Oh, okay. Well, they may or may not like even connect with you. And if they do, it might be on a narrow band, but you need all this other stuff. And so I think that's really, really important. And I also think, you know, people need to be willing to be mentors no matter where they are in their career. And we all need to be willing to be mentees, yes. Right? I'm at an age now where I have former students that are doing amazing things in the profession. Heck, they're the mentor now. I mean, I learn way more from them than I ever passed along to them. So I just felt like I need to be in a position to be the mentee to learn from what they've accomplished, which is actually kind of more fun to be the mentee, isn't it? You know?
Now, do you think mentorship ever ends, or is it ongoing throughout your career and moving forward? And then I guess the other side of that is, when do you start? Is it too early to start as a student when you're in your beginning years, or it's always ongoing?
I think it's a lifelong type of thing. I think you could choose not to be involved with that, but I think something inside you dies when that happens, right? I mean, you get kind of into a single track on that, but it's interesting in terms of seeking mentors. I think that's a really important thing to talk about, especially with early career people. And you all have encountered a lot of entry-level people in your professions.
Yeah.
Think about the ones that took the time to come to you and ask your opinion on something or ask you to help them with something. Where are they now? They're the leaders, yeah. Right? Because they took the initiative to start the ball rolling on that.
Yeah. But you also have to put yourself in their place. We were once them.
Yeah.
I mean, Riz and I met when I was a high school student and I was a mentee of Dr. Tom Beal and Dr. J.P. Warner, coming to them and saying, hey, can I learn from you? And 15, 20 years later, you know, I have students from the University of Arizona in my clinic and I have PO students and P students and they're looking to me for mentorship and I'm still looking up the chain for mentorship for me. I value a lot of my senior carvers and we were all in that position once, but I think it's important to keep that youth of growth mindset.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. And I think that our opportunity to intervene as a mentee or a mentor, I think we really need to pay attention, especially with the early career people. You know, their background could determine how they interact in that. Some people are going to have more confidence talking to, you know, a person of importance, and other people, that wasn't something they grew up with, and they really don't even know how to do that. We need to help that. You know, we need to recognize that they don't quite have the tools to do that and open a door for them so that they can begin to see, A, it's okay to ask. And in fact, we talk about this in academia all the time, right? Students are really reluctant to come to office hours to talk about that type of stuff because they think that the professor is going to be turned off by that. And it's like, we love that stuff. Yeah.
So how do you make that more obvious to the students? How do you make that more transparent to the students? That if you sit down with me during office hours, this would be the best part of my day. I want you to come to the lab. I want you to write papers with me. I want you to shadow me in the OA. How do you make that more obvious and transparent to all the trainees?
Yeah. Well, I think the faculty and the mentors need to say exactly that. Start your class by saying, look, office hours aren't a hassle to me. You know, I'm in this because I want you to learn this. So please come. That doesn't, I mean, not everybody takes that invitation up and does it. But I think that's what you can do. I don't know that you can force someone.
So it's a level of comfort given the person, because not, again, not everybody's going to want to do that. And yeah. I had a lot of, you know, clinical students or even professionals that still aren't comfortable doing that. So even you're going to probably run into that as well with, you know,
it's our job as mentors to do our best to make people feel comfortable. And sometimes there is a presupposed hierarchy gap where they call you Dr. This or Dr. That and look at you as some unattainable figure. But it's our job to come down to that level and say, look, my name's Chris, my name's Cameron, my name's Andrew. I was once you.
I know what it's like. And I know what it's like for you to sit here and watch me write notes or shadow me seeing patients. Or shadow me in the lab, or shadow me on the field. And I want to identify with you to make it not scary. So we can form a professional or personal relationship to make your training experience better. Mm-hmm.
And that's what good mentors do, right?
Yeah.
They do that and say, look, you're not expected to know what I know by the end of next week, right? It took me years and years to know this. I want to help you chop this up into bite-sized pieces so that you can also do this. And you can, you know? If you stick with it, you can get it done. But sometimes people too need mentoring, but they don't think they do. You know, there are those that are also overconfident about what they know and need to be gently sort of reminded that, maybe you could learn something by talking to person A or person B.
And I remember this clearly, and I mentioned this to Dr. Starkey, and he hates when I call him Dr. Starkey, but I'll say Chad. He said, call me Chad. Back when I was an undergrad, he says, don't forget, when you pass your certification, that's entry level for you. And then you need to then advance your skill set to become better and better and better and better. And I think that's the best message we can give to our students, is that, like you said it best, I don't expect you to learn what I know next week. And I think that's a great message to give them. And that, I think, shows a level of vulnerability to them to understand that, hey, we were at, like you mentioned, we were at your level at some point in our career. Now it's time to continue to learn and get better and ask the questions. And I always say no question is a bad question. So ask it.
Yeah, well, and I think I can attribute to Chad a statement that he would make for students when they would pass a certification exam. He would say, congratulations, you met the minimum standard to be in.
That's what you could say to us, exactly. You'll appreciate that when you listen, Pete.
That's so good.
Yes.
Well, Chris, we really appreciate your time. I know you have a lot of old things to see and a lot of great stuff to keep going here at the NRTO.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed our conversation, and best of luck.
Chris, thank you.
All right.
Thank you, my friend. That was great.
No, it's hard. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.